Hi, my name is Jess Graham, and I'm the community builder at the Transnational Institute, and I'm here to ask for your help. The work of TNI is important and cannot be done without financial resources. If you like the work we do, I encourage you to support TNI. You will help us to continue strengthening international social movements with research, reliable information, sound analysis, and constructive proposals that advance progressive, democratic policy change and common solutions to global problems. We need your help to retain a loud and independent voice in this environment. Please go to tni.org and at the top of the page, click Support Us. You can make a one-off donation or sign up as a friend of TNI and pledge a regular contribution that will help us to continue the vital work being done. Thanks a lot.
Why did the pandemic spiral out of control in India? Why did some states see many more people dying than others? The central government's authoritarian measures, badly planned lockdowns, structural inequality, and many forms of discrimination drastically increased the death toll, argues Sulakshana Nandi in this interview. She discusses India's unequal vaccination rollout and the roles of the public and private healthcare sector in pandemic management. Finally, she explains what a better health system in India could look like. Sulakshana Nandi is the co-chair of the Global Steering Council of the People's Health Movement in India. She's involved in research, capacity building, and advocacy on issues related to health equity and access, and public policy and programs for health and nutrition, with a focus on gender and vulnerable and indigenous communities. Arun Kundanani is a TNI associate and author of The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror.
Hello, and welcome to another video from the Transnational Institute. In this series of interviews, we meet people who can lay out a different vision of what global security should look like in an age of pandemics and climate breakdown. My name's Arun Kundanani. In this interview, I met Sulakshana Nandi. Sulakshana is the co-chair of the Global Steering Council of the People's Health Movement in India. She's based in Raipur in the state of Chhattisgarh. We talked about the authoritarianism of the Indian government's response to COVID and the structural discriminations and exploitations that have shaped the impact of COVID in India. Remember, if you enjoy the video, please like and subscribe and look out for the next interview, which will drop in around a month. Sulakshana, thank you for joining us today. Can we begin just by talking in kind of general terms about what the impact of COVID has been in India over the last two or so years?
If we talk about numbers in the beginning, and we talk about government numbers or the numbers that the government has published. So according to the Indian government, around 43 million people have been affected by COVID over the last 2 years. The deaths that the Indian government claims have happened are just about 0.5 million. Whereas if you look at the recent WHO report, which actually reports, 4.5 million deaths, excess deaths that would have happened in India. In India, I think the pandemic was really, marked by one, the lockdown that happened in March 2020. A complete lockdown was announced just, with 4 hours notice. So that created a lot of problems for people. It created a huge, a large humanitarian crisis. And so that was one of the defining aspects of the pandemic in India. Along with that, of course, it is a health crisis. It was a health systems crisis. So the kind of responses of the health system, the way, the public health crisis was dealt with by the government in terms of the government's COVID strategy, that again was much in discussion and had a lot left to be desired for. So there were two large waves, one in 2020 onwards and another in 2021. approximately the same time, but more or less from April 2021 onwards. In 2020, we found that a lot of the, the cases were found mostly in cities. By 2021, the pandemic had spread to rural areas and it was much more severe. We saw really serious shortages in terms of hospital beds, in terms of availability of oxygen, and the majority of the deaths, happened during that period. And the pandemic as such has really led to a huge economic and livelihood crisis for majority of the population of India, especially because, we have majority of the workers are in, unorganized sector, doing precarious work. And, this kind of an economic crisis is going to really last generations. So people had to spend from their savings, they had to sell their resources, their property, jewelry to both, survive. And also in case of, if any one of the family members got COVID and had to be hospitalized, then spending money on the treatment or, in trying to get treatment or, get adequate care for COVID. The other thing that really defined the pandemic was the lack of services, the essential or the routine services that basically shut down. So, regular services such as antenatal care, such as immunization, regular routine medicines for people with chronic diseases such as hypertension, heart disease, HIV, tuberculosis, such communicable diseases. So the regular availability of medicines, there was a problem in that, and that's really led to a lot of mortality and morbidity, as we can see in India. So when we talk about deaths and when we talk about the effect of the pandemic, we really have to see it comprehensively. We really have to see the whole gamut of COVID-related plus, the non-COVID-related. I mean, they were related to COVID in a way. They were related to the response to COVID and the government policies in response to COVID, but really not to the disease directly. But both these things really defines the pandemic for India, it being a public health crisis, a health systems crisis, and also a socio-economic crisis illustrated by high levels of stigmatization, brutality, and discrimination.
So let's get into the detail on some of those different aspects that you've just summarized. So let's talk a bit more about the lockdown policies then that you began to explore. So can you say a bit more about what those policies looked like when they came out, and where are we now with lockdown in India? Are there still those kind of things in place, and what have the impacts been for regular people in India?
So I mentioned, the first lockdown that happened, the nationwide lockdown, and the most severe one till date, really, that happened was on, the eve of 24th March 2020, when India's Prime Minister announced a 21-day lockdown nationwide, which was, of course, then extended. And this was done just by giving just a 4 hours notice. It led to a huge humanitarian and health crisis. And you had people who were stuck in places where they were working and, did not know where to go and, how to reach their residence or, the places, where they live. The lockdown led to the largest people's movement, in the country, millions of laborers, informal workers, and mainly, of course, from, the poorer communities, from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, who were working in places and locations that were different from where they live. So mainly in the metropolitan cities. So they started trying to go back. And we had so many stories of, thousands of families with children who are walking often without food and water. And while the Supreme Court of India at some point of time did take cognizance of this and ordered some relief, the government's response was really, inadequate. In addition to that, the migrant workers had to also face, police brutality. Anybody trying to violate the curfew rules, it was seen as criminal negligence, and the power was really in the hands of the Home Ministry. So it was the Home Ministry that basically took charge of the pandemic response, because, in mid-March, the National Disaster Management Act came into force, which was then implemented with a strong sort of rule of hand by the Home Minister and the Home Ministry. So a public health crisis was really, responded to like, a military operation. And we also find migrant workers being sprayed with pesticides, wherever they reached different locations, and before they were entering other cities, other towns. For many days, workers were stranded at different locations. There was at one point of time an order saying that, they need to be put into large stadium-like prisons. And there was very little help by the government to help them to go to their native places. Other than migrant workers, even health workers who were going to their work, for example, so you had your frontline workers, health and allied workers, for instance, you had doctors, you had nurses, you had community health workers called the ASHAs, sanitary workers, cleaners, etc., who, had to go to work daily. And many of them had to walk to work because there was no public transport. There was complete shutting down of all public transport, including trains. And they faced a lot of, the brunt of the police. So, we have had instances of health workers being beaten up by the police just bobbing on the road while going for their job. And such kind of brutality was more on poorer health workers. For instance, workers who were traveling by cycles, or walking. So they were more likely to face the brunt of the police rather than somebody, going by car, etc. So like I said, all the transportation was, stopped. And so even people who needed to go to hospitals, all work was stopped, all factories were closed down, and people who had to go for essential work, for treatment or for any emergencies, to buy food, none of the shops were open, all the shops were closed. It was a really huge crisis, for availability of food and availability of livelihoods. And there were some attempts by government, much later, to sort of provide some subsidies, food, materials, etc. But at this point of time, we find that it was mainly citizens' groups and collectives and civil society who really, and the community themselves trying to help each other, who really responded to the crisis that was ongoing at that time. The implications of the lockdown was so severe on the economy and on livelihoods of people. After that, we saw sporadic lockdowns, or states or districts would announce lockdowns depending on the, severity of the pandemic in their area. So in the next few months, we actually saw more sort of localized kind of lockdowns, which were nevertheless as, backbreaking as the, the nationwide one. But that was sort of concentrated in certain areas, in certain regions, or in certain cities. However, the brutality and the problems for people continued, even through these, smaller, more localized lockdowns.
Mm-hmm. And can you say a little about what has been the vaccination situation in India?
Right now, I think India has one of the, better, proportions of adults vaccinated. And mainly because we do have, production locally of vaccines that we were able to use. I think more than 80% of the adult population, according to the government, has been fully vaccinated. And India has also started vaccination for below 18. So vaccination started, in phases from January 2021. And the initial vaccination policy that the government brought out was very regressive. It left it to the state governments to procure the vaccines. And we all know, the amount of vaccines you procure, if the amount is much more, you're able to negotiate a better price and a better deal from the manufacturers. Mm-hmm. But here we saw that the state governments were really left to their own devices to procure the vaccines and distribute it. Indian government did not have, any emphasis on providing vaccination free of cost. And it did not regulate vaccines that were being provided in the private sector. And there was also no prioritization of, high-risk groups or groups who were at most risk or were most vulnerable or, who could not access vaccinations otherwise. However, there was a lot of backlash against this policy, and even the court intervened, and including organizations such as People's Health Movement in India in different states also intervened in terms of certain legal petitions. And finally, the government revised this policy, and it really depended still upon the states to, basically make the vaccines more accessible to people. So in the state where I live, in Chhattisgarh, the government was able to have a higher coverage of vaccinations because the health workers went to villages. The community health workers in the state were really involved in mobilizing people to access the vaccinations. The vaccines were given free of cost and mostly in the public sector. And that has been the experience for the whole of the country. Even though the government had reserved some vaccines for the private sector to give, more than 90% of the vaccination, COVID vaccination in India has been by the public sector. And now when some of the vaccines that are left over in the private sector that could not get used, are about to expire. So now, the government has sort of opened the booster doses in the private sector to basically, utilize those vaccines. But like I was saying, so there were governments who did a good job in terms of reaching people, covering people in rural and remote areas, to indigenous communities, like we saw in the state where I live in. However, there was a lot of problems in many other states because the vaccine appointments were linked to smartphones, and there was an app through which you had to take an appointment for vaccination, and we find huge problems faced by people who were poor, who did not have these resources. And there was a lot of media and, public outrage against this. And I think slowly some of these problems have been resolved. But it was a very unequal and inequitable kind of progress that happened. And poorer people, because of these reasons, could get access to vaccines much later if we, look at the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. You've written that there is a need to examine the key structural determinants that have contributed to the disproportionate effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on marginalized and other groups. So can you talk about how those structural factors have led to COVID having quite different impacts on different groups in India? Whether, you've already talked a little about precarious workers, but also thinking of like women, migrant workers. How is that kind of stigmatization playing out in India?
In the beginning, there was a lot of, and the stigmatization really continued throughout the pandemic. But in the beginning, there was also communalization of the pandemic. We saw in one particular case, a Muslim community gathering was really targeted as being like the place from where the pandemic started. And this was something that the government was also very actively sort of articulating. So when we say that, you know, there is, you know, the structural determinants, you know, really contributed. I mean, we really mean, you know, the different kinds of determinants of health that we see, for instance, you know, the socioeconomic determinants such as caste, such as the kind of working conditions that people are subjected to, the kind of gender-based discrimination, occupation-based discrimination, and also public policies that really sort of shape, you know, the way the society, Indian society is, and, you know, the responses to such crisis, you know, how those things are shaped, you know, it all depends on these. And we see that, you know, precarious workers, more and more, we find that even within the healthcare work, more and more work has become like a contractual work. And you know, work has become more precarious with you know, the labor conditions being really undermined. And especially we look at you know, the community health workers who played a very significant role in India's response to the COVID pandemic, the ASHA workers. And in fact, they I mean, only last week received sort of an award from the World Health Organization as one of the global leaders in health. But when you actually look at their working conditions, yeah, they're not given fair wages and they're not adequately compensated for the amount of work that they put in, even during COVID. Existing systems and structures of discrimination and exploitation basically, you know, got reinforced and exacerbated. Another example I would like to give you is, you know, for instance, you know, trans persons have always had a, you know, a problem in sort of sometimes, you know, showing their identity or making ID cards. And a lot of these programs, you know, subsidized grain, etc., this social welfare schemes that the government introduced necessitated, you know, that, you know, you own a ID card, Aadhaar card, and, you know, only then you would get that food support, etc. But a lot of trans persons who have had to, you know, come out of their houses without, you know, collecting the proper documents, etc., find it very difficult to make these cards. And therefore, you know, they could not even apply for this kind of social welfare scheme or food subsidies that were given to other, you know, populations. You know, so like, so this really, you know, showed that, you know, the you know, the people or the communities within society, you know, who were marginalized, basically bore the brunt of the pandemic. And pandemic was in no way a leveler, because, you know, it was very stark, the difference in which you know, the differences in which government would, you know, respond to, for instance, people coming in from abroad, you know, like, you know, students who are studying abroad, and, you know, the kind of services the government provided to them to bring them back to India, and the services they provided for migrant workers to go to their native places, you know, it just, like I said, you know, it just reflected the you know, the sort of historical, you know, discrimination and marginalization of the communities, and it really exacerbated all those problems and issues faced by these communities.
Mm-hmm. So you referred earlier to the contrast between how the private sector and the public sector have dealt with vaccination. So in India, there is a you know, it's a mixed system, private and public, and the private sector is generally used by the kind of middle and upper classes. But can you talk, you know, and the general trend, I guess, has been towards privatization, right? Especially over the last few decades, right? And so can you talk about how, more generally, how the kind of public sector and private sector each, like, what was their role in dealing with COVID, not just in terms of vaccination, but more broadly, testing, hospitals, and so on? What was their respective roles?
So you're correct, you know, when you say that, you know, over the last few decades, the thrust of, you know, the health sector reform was to shift from, you know, investing in the public sector to, you know, to both, you know, a privatization that was passive in terms of, you know, an underfunded public sector that would really lead people to shift to the private sector, or even active privatization, such as through the publicly funded insurance schemes that were introduced in India, the main beneficiaries of which are the for-profit private sector. So we saw that, you know, over the last few decades, more and more public money has been going into the private sector, private, healthcare sector through insurance and different forms of public-private partnership. And but, you know, when the pandemic broke, you know, the most private sector hospitals completely closed down and, you know, abandoned healthcare provisioning. And some of them resumed after a couple of months, but they would really turn away cases of COVID and you know, refuse to treat them. So the response was varied in terms of the various states. But overall, the experience has been that despite being, underfunded and neglected, it was the public sector who basically, took care of most of the testing, most of the management of COVID, and of course, of vaccination, like I previously told you. And, you know, whereas in the private sector, we find whether it was for COVID or for non-COVID, healthcare, there was, extensive price gouging and inappropriate care, a lot of irrational, inappropriate care of, different medicines, plasma therapy, and, all these things for which, people had to just arrange money from anywhere. There was, crowdsourcing. There was a lot of, like I said, selling their property, using up all their savings. So all that happened mainly in the private sector. And the publicly funded health insurance scheme that, of which most money had been going to the private sector, really failed to provide free healthcare to people who were enrolled under that scheme. And despite this kind of performance by the private sector, the Indian government has continued to promote the for-profit private sector and commercialization of healthcare. Whereas I think not only in India, but even globally, it's been very clear that, in wherever, whichever places the public sector was strong and the public sector response was strong, the health system's response to the pandemic was much, much better and with less, exploitation and inconvenience, to people, and also, more equity, more equitable healthcare. So, traditionally, and, if you look at the evidence, even in India, the most vulnerable and marginalized groups, communities, women, indigenous communities, Dalit communities, and the poorest, whether it's in rural or urban area, go to the public sector for treatment. And during the pandemic, in fact, even the middle class had to go to the public sector for treatment because in many states only that was available. And I must say that in many states, the public sector hospitals, whether it were district hospitals or tertiary level hospitals at the state level, were improved and, services expanded in terms of improving oxygen availability, in terms of improving some of the infrastructure. However, the problem still remains of human resources. The government, again, does not want to invest in human resources. So we have a shortage of healthcare workers within the public system, which is not related to the availability of healthcare workers. I mean, there are enough nurses, at least nurses, at least in the state I work in, there are more than enough nurses if the government wants to recruit them. But this, this whole idea of austerity and austerity policies and, underfunding of the public sector has really led to, really severe shortages of health workers, which the government should have learned from, from the pandemic, but they didn't. And even during the pandemic, the health workers that they recruited were for short periods. So they were giving them contracts for like 3 months or 6 months. And after 3 months, they would extend the contract for another 3 months, as if, they were not needed on a long-term basis. So that continues to be a problem.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak about the organization that you work with, the People's Health Movement, and the work that this organization is doing, and what kinds of kind of alternative approaches to healthcare can be advocated in India?
So the People's Health Movement is a global movement. We have work, you know, we have country circles in over 70 countries and mainly in lower and middle income countries. And our thrust is on ensuring the right to health, and which we sort of articulate in a very comprehensive and holistic manner. As, you know, incorporating the social determinants of health, incorporating, you know, issues of peace, issues of justice and social justice. So in India, the, you know, the civil society and also the People's Health Movement, or the Jan Swasthya Abhiyan, as it is called in India, did actively keep responding to the various challenges that were emerging. So one of the things that we did was, you know, advocacy, which also included, you know, litigation. So like I also previously mentioned, but advocacy in terms of, you know, exposing the gaps, inadequacies of the policies of the government. So we, for instance, brought out, you know, more than 35 position papers and resolutions, and wrote letters to the government in terms of, you know, what they can do to improve their pandemic response. The other role was in building public awareness and, you know, combating fear and stigma, and basically countering the kind of misinformation that was being spread through different social media and even sometimes by politicians and by, you know, government officials themselves. So that was another important role that, you know, we had to play in different states. And the third was, you know, really direct action on, you know, relief activities, providing, I mean, and not only Jan Swasthya Abhiyan, but a number of organizations and networks who are associated, and other civil society networks and campaigns, basically providing relief, you know, direct relief activities, whether it was healthcare, whether it was distribution of food, whether, you know, distribution of critical supplies, setting up health lines for grievance redressal, for mental health counseling. And there was also a lot of use of social media, you know, because, I mean, clearly, you know, the government systems for providing information on hospitals, on availability of beds, of, you know, where people can go for help or, you know, for any relief. Those systems really broke down and they were really not working in most states. So a lot of this, you know, helplines, telephonic conversations, social media, you know, had to be used by civil society and collectives, you know, to help people. And but it was also important that, you know, alongside this relief work, we also needed to keep on analyzing the kind of the large, you know, the larger policies of government. So the government really took this opportunity to also, you know, like I said, you know, bring out policies that privatize the public health system further. We also saw the government bring out policies that were, you know, against labor rights, or made amendments to the agricultural bill that would do a lot of damage to small farmers. And support to these campaigns also happened simultaneously. Unfortunately, there was a lot of attack on civil liberties and freedom of expression during this time. The government really did not encourage any critical analysis, whether it was in terms of, you know, information coming out regarding deaths or regarding cases due to COVID or otherwise. So the government, you know, not only came down on civil society, but also on journalists and media. So that was another sort of challenge that the civil society had to really work with. And basically to reemphasize the importance of civil liberties and democratic functioning.
Well, Sulakshana, thank you for sharing your knowledge with us today. Next month, I'll be speaking with Tobita Chow on US-China relations in the context of COVID. And that video is going to drop on August the 6th, 17th. So make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel so you get that when it comes out. Thank you very much.
You're listening to the State of Power podcast from the Transnational Institute. This was a conversation between TNI associate Arun Kundanani and Sulakshana Nandi, who is the co-chair of the Global Steering Council of the People's Health Movement in India. This episode is part of a monthly series on the securitization of health hosted by Arun Kundanani. Be sure to also check out previous episodes and of course look out for upcoming ones. TNI's material is all free, but we would greatly appreciate your help to keep doing the work we do. One of the ways you can help out is simply to rate our podcast on whichever platform you're listening from. And please write us a review, which will only help us to get better at what we do. If you'd like to find out more about how you can boost TNI's work, please click on the Support TNI tab on our website, tni.org. If you have specific questions, requests, or suggestions for the podcast, please send an email to podcast@tni.org. You can, of course, also find us on social media at Transnational Institute on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Thank you for joining us today, and be sure to tune in next time.